Welcome to the Microsoft IT Pro Podcast, a show about Office 365, Azure, and the IT Pro and end user side of life. Each week, we'll discuss a different topic or recent news related to Office 365 and Azure and how it relates to you as an IT Pro. The MS IT Pro Podcast is never longer than 30 minutes, so let's get started. Here we are again, Scott. Another day, about 3 or 4 days after we recorded our last episode.
It's time to build up a backlog again.
Yeah, I know, right? The nice thing is we're always up to date because we're not recording like 2 or 3 weeks in advance. And who knows how much stuff will change in 2 or 3 weeks.
This is very, very, very true.
What day is it? It's Wednesday, right? The day before Thanksgiving here in the U.S. So we decided we'd record a little earlier this week so we could both enjoy our holiday, long holiday weekend.
Yeah, before all that turkey and tryptophan and all that good stuff hits. And then hopefully when people are still comatose next week, if you're in the U.S., if you're not, go out and have a turkey sandwich or something, you know, really carby that's going to make you sleepy. And then go ahead and listen to this for a half hour. You'll be all set.
Exactly. So we decided we would try to switch it up a little bit this week and talk about something a little more, well, still in the cloud, but not as much Office 365, and dive into a few Azure IaaS topics.
Yeah, so I figured it'd be fun. We've done some things in the past, right? Just kind of getting started with Azure. We've talked about workloads like automation. And lately, I've been talking a lot to customers about core lift and shift scenarios. So we've been doing a lot with virtual machines, virtualization, containers, things like that. So I thought it'd be helpful to, or fun, to just go ahead and do a, you know, a really quick 30 minutes on virtual machines in Azure specifically, and what that is and what's involved with just kind of getting through and standing up your first virtual machine. And then maybe we can do a couple follow-ons later on down the road for more advanced topics or hybrid or anything like that that comes into play in that space.
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds like a good plan. So how to get started with virtual machines? I've been doing virtual machines in Azure for a while. You have too. Where do you start when you're looking at virtual machines in Azure?
I think the easiest place to start is go ahead and sign into your account and sign into the portal. And all you're going to do is go ahead and click create new, and then you're going to start searching. And you're just going to search for a virtual machine. And you're going to see a bunch of compute options pop up, right? You're going to see Windows servers and Linux servers. And if you're an MSDN subscriber, you're going to see things like Windows clients. Let's take Windows server, right? Because it tends to be the first one in the list when you search for virtual machine. So you're going to say, yes, I want a Windows server 2016 virtual machine to go ahead and be spun up. And you're going to be presented with a bunch of blades in the portal, and they're going to walk you through a wizard where you're going to say, what mode do you want that virtual machine to be spun up in? Are we going to do that in Classic or Azure Service Manager? Are we going to do that in ARM or Azure Resource Manager? So you're going to select Resource Manager because that's the new way of doing things, right? Like friends don't let friends build things in Classic anymore.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to say. Just like Office 365, you don't do business. Azure, you don't do Classic.
There you go. So it's all very straightforward. So once you've selected your deployment model, or really the API that's going to be used on the back end to provision and kind of host your virtual machine, you're going to be presented with a set of blades that are going to walk you through a really quick wizard. And they're going to do things like, tell me the region that you would like to host this virtual machine in. Tell me how big you want the virtual machine to be, right? So we have multiple series that are in Azure. So we have things like A0 basics, or I can have, you know, an A0 standard. I can have a DV server. I can have a DV2. I have F series, G series, N series. I have burstable compute. So you're going to have to kind of know your workload, right? And understand what you're going to spin up. I think in most cases, kind of Classic compute, most folks would be in like that DV2 space right now. It gives you a couple options when we get a little bit further on through the wizard, a little bit more flexibility. You do have to watch what happens when you pick that type of virtual machine, because the type and series of virtual machine drives some features later, like the number of disks I can have associated with it, and potentially the types of disks that I can have associated with it, spinning rust versus SSD, things like that. So let's say we did like a DV2, right? Just something in DV2, like D4 or something like that. So we're going to say, yep, I want my machine to be this big, and the portal is going to be very clear. It's going to tell you how much that machine costs per month. It's going to give you a monthly cost. Keep in mind, your virtual machine price is billed per minute and rounded down to the lowest minute. So you see a lot of providers, AWS and Google come to mind, where they will tell you they do per second billing. So in Azure land, everything is billed per minute. And quite often that's to your favor as a customer over something like per second billing. So for instance, if we run a VM for 3 minutes and 30 seconds in Amazon, I'm going to get charged for 3 minutes and 30 seconds of compute inside of EC2, right? Pretty straightforward. But if I go into Azure and I run that same VM for 3 minutes and 30 seconds, I'm only going to get charged for 3 minutes because they round down to the lowest minute. So even if I run that thing for 3 minutes and 59 seconds, as long as I get it shut down in time, I'm still only charged for 3 minutes. So I'm getting, you know, seconds of compute for free. It's amazing. So we're going to go ahead, select our series. Our series is going to drive some decisions around our storage. So again, we have kind of standard tiers of storage. We have premium tiers of storage. And then we have both managed and unmanaged storage within there. So select your storage, select your VM size. We're going to make some decisions around networking. So we're going to create what's called a virtual network with this machine, which is effectively a software-defined network. So it's an IP address space. It defines subnets. And then we select which subnets we want our virtual machine to exist in, right? So if I create a VNet or a virtual network and it has four subnets, right? Maybe I do like a core and a services and a data and like an end user tier, like a client tier. You know, we would select the appropriate one, continue to next our way through that quick storage experience. So again, where do I want my storage to be hosted? What's the name of my storage account? Things like that. Maybe I select an existing one, whatever it happens to be. Eventually, we'll make it through the wizard and we'll make it to a point where we select what are called extensions. So there is a kind of post-deployment methodology built into Azure virtual machines, both Linux and Windows. They have different extensions they can run where you can say, maybe for a Windows machine, I would like it to always have anti-malware. So Microsoft has an anti-malware extension that they offer for free in the gallery as just a gallery extension. Or maybe you say we're a McAfee shop and I want to run McAfee antivirus. Well, there's also an extension for that. Or maybe you say, I want to be able to run a custom script when this thing is over and as soon as it boots up so it can do a bunch of bootstrapping. So let me just point it at a custom PowerShell script that maybe lives in another storage account someplace, right? Someplace that Azure service can access when it goes ahead and spins up that VM. Because we're doing a Windows machine, we're going to have to select whether we brought our Windows license or not with it. So there's a kind of a hybrid SA button. It's just a checkbox in the portal right now. So basically, if I need to pay Microsoft for my Windows licensing on that per hour licensing, I'm going to go ahead and say, nope, give me a license. I'm not bringing one with me. If I do have one because I have some SA benefits or hybrid usage benefits, I'm going to just go ahead and say, well, I already got my Windows license. So go ahead and chunk 10% of the cost per hour off the cost of that VM just to make it a little bit easier and more palatable for me as a customer. And then I'm going to click next a couple more times. It's going to say, yes, are you sure you really want to do this? And you go ahead and click create. And then you just wait. Typically for some of those smaller VMs, I mean, you're talking just a couple of minutes to have everything spun up in the fabric and created for you and ready to go. Larger VMs can take more time because it's not just bootstrapping them, but Microsoft has to find a place with, you know, those hundreds of thousands of cores in a data center. So what's the appropriate rack or pod or whatever piece of hardware and host is going to run my virtual machine for me? Where's it going to go? We're going to wait. It's going to go through a deployment under Resource Manager, right? Because we said, hey, Resource Manager, do your thing. So you're going to have visibility into that deployment, what step it's at, all those kinds of things. Your VM is going to start up. you're going to see that it is in a running state when you go into the portal and look for virtual machines. And once a VM is in a running state, you can go ahead and connect to it. So in our case, we created a Windows VM, right? We're going to go ahead and just click connect. It's going to download an RDP file, and we're going to go ahead and hopefully be able to connect to it. As long as we had set up our network the right way, and as long as we had set up our network security group, or really a kind of like that software edge firewall the right way, and as long as we had allocated a public IP, and as long as we remembered the username. Just a couple of things to get in there and make it all work, right?
Yeah. Nice and simple, like you said. There's a few steps in there.
So the portal presents about four steps or four blades that you have to fill out information to. It really is a next kind of wizard thing. And because this is cloud, we have all that elasticity and tear up, tear down, all that good stuff. If you happen to make a mistake, you've got a couple options there. So you can always go back and just blow away the stuff you just created, right? We're just going to delete it and start over. Maybe we next our way through it again. One of the really cool things about Azure Resource Manager and ARM is it's really just an API, right? It's a programmatic way for us to interact with the service fabric and all the things Azure's doing as a cloud provider for us in the background. So when we're going through and we're doing all that nexting through a wizard, what Microsoft is really doing on the portal side is they're building a declaration for what your VM should be, right? They're basically going to have a declarative configuration that says, oh, you know, Scott or Ben, they went through the portal, they selected this, and this. And that declarative declaration is really just a JSON file. So that's what's called an ARM template, right? But the really cool thing is once my resource has been created, whether I created it through the portal, I created it through a Bash script or a PowerShell script, or I created it through some other template that I found someplace else, I can always go ahead and access the template that was actually used to create the machine just through Microsoft's interface. So I can go into PowerShell, pull that template, I can go through the portal and go into the automation blade under your virtual machine once it's been created, and I can select automation, and that will actually give me the template back, right? So should I have made a mistake in that thing, and I say, you know what, next time I'd like to automate this, or I really like the way this one came out, I would like to have five more just like it. You can very easily go pull that configuration file, that ARM template down, and Microsoft also provides the kind of stub PowerShell or Bash script to go ahead and execute that template to be able to spin up more and more and more of these things. Because, hey, the cloud's all about automation, right?
Exactly. And that's one of those big benefits of ARM is, like you mentioned, that whole templatization of your VMs. If you were around, if you ever spun up VMs in classic mode, there really wasn't that ability. Every time you needed a new VM, it was click, click, click through the interface. Now with these templates, you can template your whole VM. You can even template resources that maybe you want configured in the VM. You can do subnets. You can tie in even other Azure services to it. So maybe you're spinning something up for a class you're teaching. You need 20 identical VMs. Or like you said, you're scaling out. You have, coming from the SharePoint world, maybe you're running your SharePoint instance, SharePoint 2013, 2016 in Azure. You want to be able to quickly spin up additional web front ends or application servers. Once you have this template, it's really easy to create however many identical VMs you want to without risking clicking on the wrong button, typing the wrong thing, any of those types of things in that kind of next click through GUI.
It's gotten a lot better over time, right? And flexibility is built in for us as customers. So no one is saying you must use the portal, or no one is saying you must use ARM templates. I think there's a heavy bias, right? And it is a best practice to go ahead and do those things because we do want to do infrastructure as code and declarative provisioning and those kinds of things. But if you're your skill set within your shop is built 100% around PowerShell or Bash or just batch scripting, right? Instead of like command prompts, you're going to have a bunch of options to go ahead and provision that way as well and continue to interact with those same APIs.
I like it. One other nice thing, and I can't remember, it's been so long since I've used Classic. I can't remember how all of this works with Classic, but at least with ARM, you have all of these components. So when you build a VM, you're essentially connecting a whole bunch of different components together. You're connecting the hard drive, the network cards, the VM itself. There was actually one, I think about a year ago, I was playing with my VMs and I accidentally was browsing through my VMs, hit the delete button, and deleted the VM itself, but it didn't go through and automatically delete the network card or the hard drive that had the OS on it or any of those. And I was actually going to, I did it in PowerShell, but was able to go into PowerShell, craft a script that essentially stood up a brand new VM, but pulled in all those other resources from my original, and my VM came right back up. The OS came in, it just kind of reconnected all those resources, and I was right back where I left off.
Yeah, so in today's world with ARM, it kind of depends, right? How I deleted the VM. There's this concept of in Azure Resource Manager of resources, right? So typically there's a hierarchy there. There's what's called your subscription, right? So I sign into a subscription. And then within that subscription, I create these things called resource groups, which are really just logical containers or kind of boxes. You know, think about like a container or box on a Visio diagram, right? That then I can put resources inside of. So one of the things to keep in mind is a resource group, and it's a little confusing, but stay with me. A resource group is also a resource. So it is a resource that can hold other resources. So when you go to delete that VM, because a virtual machine, when you created it in Resource Manager, it's going to be created inside of a resource group. So if I delete the resource group, everything else in the resource group goes away too, right? Because it was kind of a container or a box, and everything contained in that box, if I take it out to the curb to throw out my rubbish, it's all going at the same time. So in that case, you know, typically my resource group that has a VM is also going to have the NIC. It might have the storage account. It might have a public IP address, might have a load balancer, might have an availability set, might have like a diagnostic storage account, could have potentially all sorts of stuff in there, right? So if I delete the resource group, all that stuff goes away. Really no recovery there because I deleted not only the VM, but I deleted the storage account, which contained the VHD, and I cleaned out the definition of the NIC and the load balancer and the availability set, all those other things. The flip side of that is I can go into that resource group and delete just the VM, and I can leave the NIC there, and I can leave the storage account there, and I can leave all that other stuff there. So when I go to recreate another VM, I can say, hey, I already had it. Just use the existing OS disk. Or in that case, maybe I want to rebuild the OS disk, right? But I want to bring over like a data disk, like I had like a D drive or an E drive or a log drive or something like that, that I want to bring over and provision into that service. So you do have to be a little bit careful. But again, we're in complete control as customers as to how that happens. And they're pretty good about when you delete a resource group, at least through the portal, the UI will flag you and it won't let you just click the delete button and yes. You actually have to do a couple things. Like I have to type in, the name of the resource group exactly. So Microsoft's kind of trying to stop you and say, think about it for a second. Are you sure that you really want to do this before you go ahead and get down that path?
It's a nice interface. I've really enjoyed it. So speaking of all of these resources, resource groups, resources you have available to the VMs, one of these resources that I've actually spent a lot of time playing with and ended up diving into way deeper than I ever anticipated was some of these storage account hard drives, how the speed of the drives is affected in the cloud, how you can optimize the speed. Again, I was a SharePoint guy. I was standing at my SharePoint farm and I wanted my SQL server to be really fast. So I started doing some testing, some performance, I guess calculations for lack of a better word, on hard drive speed, trying to figure out how it all worked. And it's changed a bit recently too to actually make it easier. But like you said, when you come to hard drives, when you're standing up a server, you do have that choice too between a standard hard drive, spinning platters, and SSDs. So naturally, the SSDs are significantly faster than the hard drives or the HDDs, I think, or is that HHD? It's HHD. Anyways, so, no, it is HDD. Come on, Scott, correct me.
You'll get there. I'm just waiting for you to like take a sip of coffee in the middle, get your brain together. It'll be okay. And I'm just watching your geek street cred like burn in flames here.
Thanks. As you spin these up, again, they have different speeds. So as you're trying to figure all of this out, one thing you need to look at is those drive speeds. So your SSDs have a max IOPS, a max throughput. Same thing with your HDDs. So that's the first thing to take into consideration. The next thing is different VM sizes also have limits. So like you were talking about some of the V2 series, a DS12 is limited to 12,800 IOPS. You get up to a DS13, you have 25,600 IOPS. What you need to pay attention to is the disk IOPS are a lot lower than the VMs. So in order to actually get the max number of IOPS that they specify in these VMs is you have to add multiple disks and then stripe them all. So for instance, most of the disks, it's 500 IOPS, at least for the HDDs, the SSDs. I think it varies based on the series of the SSD, but you have to say, okay, I need to stripe maybe 8 disks or 10 disks or 12 disks to achieve that max number of IOPS to get the greatest speed. And they've changed some of that around now, where before you have to pick disks, storage accounts were also limited. So kind of like what you were talking about, you have a resource group. In a resource group, you have a storage account. In your storage account, you have hard drives. So you can maybe put 32, 40, 50, 60, whatever hard drives in a storage account, and you may still find yourself limited by limits on the storage account. So then you'd have to break out disks across multiple storage accounts. It could get really confusing in a hurry in terms of how you had to break all this out to get the maximum speed. One thing Microsoft has implemented now is these managed disks, where they take care of a lot of the stuff around storage accounts, size of the disk, making sure that that's not going to be your limiting factor. Your limiting factor may still be the actual IOPS of the disk when it's attached to the VM. But that's going to be a lot easier to calculate, a lot easier to figure out. And it takes out some of the calculations to achieve that maximum speed.
So there's a couple things that happen there, right? I can't tell you the number of conversations that, and I'm sure you have them too, with customers or folks at user groups or just people on the street, where you go in and you say, you know, you'd like to provision a workload, and you say, well, what are your requirements for IOPS? And they kind of like blink or fall asleep, or they have no idea what you're talking about, right? And you go, well, you're going to run a SQL server, so we need some kind of provisioned IO for you, right? We want it to be quote unquote performant. And they look at you and they go, I don't know, it just kind of like works today. You know, I go to my MSP or I go to my data center and they just give me disk and it is what it is. So one of the big things with cloud is to get the best efficiencies out of it, right? Whether it's, I want it to perform this way, or I want to make sure it doesn't cost more than this, or whatever it happens to be, you have to understand the performance metrics and really desired performance state of your applications, right? Once they're up, whether it's a COTS application like SharePoint, right? And I want to just get it to steady state, or whether it's my custom web app that needs to read out of a SQL database or do this thing over here, whatever it is, right? Performance is kind of key. There are a bunch of different types of disks today. So effectively, there is, like you said, there's standard and premium storage. And then each of those kind of tiers of storage, so spinning rust versus SSD, you also have managed and unmanaged disks within there. So unmanaged disks, so say I take like a standard storage account, unmanaged disk, I have to worry about a lot of those things that you talked about. So 20,000 requests per second is my upper bound. So do I have too many VM hard drives like OS drives or data drives or whatever running inside of the storage account? Am I going to get throttled? And are my VMs going to slow down? That's really tough for most customers to be able to like rationalize, right? Like, how does my IO on my disk translate into requests per second across all these various workloads that I'm going to stand up in VMs? And Microsoft never really gave you a great calculator. They didn't say, right, if I do a read out of a SQL Server database and it's on a 64K block, but I do that read 80,000 times a second, how many requests per second is that to my storage? You know, it was kind of like, well, stand it up and see, because it might be your mileage may vary against the other person's. So managed disks take all that out. Microsoft literally manages the disk for you. You buy into an SLA for things like your IO disk availability, all that good stuff. And then because Microsoft is handling all of that kind of automatic provisioning across multiple storage accounts, you are paying by the request now. You don't really have an upper bound. Like theoretically, there's an upper bound on the number of requests you can make, but it's going to be really, really, really high because, you know, you can have 200 storage accounts in a subscription, all that good stuff, just to kind of keep continuing to push it up. You do pay more for premium storage, right? Because Microsoft's coming in and they're managing that for you as a service, at least the provisioning of disks and disk availability and, again, what your performance metric is, right? Right? What my target on a disk is to get down there. You have to watch out for that. And really, like, long story short, you have to understand your applications to bring them over and make them successful in any one of these cloud providers, right? I could go to Microsoft and do a managed premium disk, or I could go over to AWS and I could be doing my EC2 instance and I could do provisioned IOPS on an S3 account, right? Same kind of thing. Either way, either provider, I needed to understand what that was and where I wanted to be.
One last thing too, when it comes to these disks, as you stand them up in your VMs, always stripe them. You don't need to do RAID 10. You don't need to do RAID 5. You don't need to do RAID 6. I walk into so many customers and they're like, you mean you just stripe them all? What about redundancy? Microsoft takes care of all of that for you. If you want speed, just stripe your disks. That'll give you the maximum throughput, the maximum IOPS. Again, these VHDs are replicated multiple times throughout the data centers. You don't have to worry about that RAID redundancy when you're doing these VMs in Azure.
So real quick, let's talk about what that is. Because I think when you say stripe a disk, you know, an existing person who's worked with SANs or something be like, where do I go to my storage account and stripe that? You don't do any of it in your storage account, right? We're talking about doing this software striping inside of VMs. So if I stand up that Windows Server 2016 VM, I'm going to create a Windows Server storage space and I'm going to attach all those different disks to my VM. And then I'm going to do software striping inside there, right? It's just JBOD inside of those. So you've got to choose kind of how the storage spaces come together and what that is and do some light math in your head, right? So if I'm on a standard disk with 500 IOPS, that's theoretically 500 max. Like I've never seen anybody hit the theoretical max other than Microsoft in a demo. You know, if I need 2000 IOPS, well, that means I need four disks that are all going to be striped together inside that storage space. The other thing customers need to realize is you're only charged for the space you use, at least in those unmanaged SKUs and standard SKUs. You're not charged for what you provision, right? So if I say I want a 1 terabyte disk, but I only load 100 megs of data on it, I'm only getting charged for 100 megs. So if you ever think you're going to grow and your disk is going to need to be a terabyte someday, make it a terabyte in the beginning, and then just go ahead and do all that striping and push all that stuff across.
Networking is the other one. We might need another podcast on this.
I think we'll have to do another one. So we can kind of leave it there, right? Like we went ahead, we created a VM, next. We did it all through the portal. We talked a little bit about storage. Maybe we can do some follow-ups on networking and a little bit more around that deployment methodology with ARM and scripting, whether it's PowerShell, Bash, or a CLI, things like that.
All right. Well, thanks again, Scott. Another good episode, and have a great Thanksgiving. All of you that are listening, I hope you had a great Thanksgiving, and we will talk to you next week.
Thanks, bud.
If you enjoyed the podcast, go leave us a 5-star rating in iTunes. It helps to get the word out so more IT pros can learn about Office 365 and Azure. If you have any questions you want us to address on the show or feedback about the show, feel free to reach out via our website, Twitter, or Facebook. Thanks again for listening and have a great day.